session number 27074, Reel 8.
So, Bamberger Reel 8. Squadron Leader, can you tell me a little bit about, obviously during that fighting, the claim system that operated with enemy aircraft shot down?
Well, in this in-air combat, things happen very quickly. And I can really only talk about my own experience, which was always fighter against fighter, not so much shooting at bombers. So some of the Hurricane pilots in particular may not agree with me on some point. But claim an aircraft confirmed, I would say was difficult, but with so many people shooting at so many aircraft, obviously there was a duplication went on, genuine duplication. Most of my combat reports during the Battle of Britain are just for probables or possibles. I never went along with this idea of sharing an aircraft with someone, or a part of an aeroplane, or half an aeroplane, and claim, or something like that. My only one positive claim confirmed during the Battle of Britain, though there it is in black and white in official records, I have no recollection of that particular combat. For to me, my probables and possibles, including this confirmed, were all mixed up in a day's work. Now then, there were obviously an element of pilots, for whatever reason, felt they couldn't come back to base without having claimed something. And mostly if they claimed anything, it would be a confirmed. Now then, at this stage, we didn't have camera guns. I think there were one or two floating around in fighter command, but the average squadron pilot didn't have one. So a person's statement had to be taken as it was. Occasionally, someone could verify the claim, which was very, very nice, but that didn't happen very frequently. I also think some pilots, whether good or not so good in the air, probably got a little depressed by coming back to the squadron and they'd taken part in the same combat with other parts of the squadron, and other parts were claiming confirms and confirms and confirms, and they were not claiming anything. So I think once or twice false claims were put in. Again, it's only reflecting on the past and attitudes of certain pilots you remember who always seem to land and claim something. Otherwise, there were more genuine mistakes than there were false claims, I think.
It sounds to me that there must be quite a lot of pressure on pilots within the squadron to make some kind of record of combat.
Well, if you came back, the first people who were interested before you got were the ground crew. And if they seen, because you had patches over your gun where your gun fired out, so there didn't affect the airflow. And they were shot off, of course, when you fired your guns. They're on a canvas. And so the ground crew saw you fire the guns, the first people that were up by the side of the carpet, what did you get, you see? And I suppose, I've had much experience this, probably said, I probably got one, or I may have damaged one. Wasn't very inspiring for the ground crew, so I suppose even that possibly may have put pressure before they got to the intelligence briefing.
Could you tell me a little bit about the intelligence briefing? What would occur after an operation during the Battle of Britain?
Well, I'm trying to talk about the average pilot in a squadron. You'd land, and in many ways you were shattered. Certainly after you'd been doing it for a few days or a few weeks. You were tired, sleepy, tense. You didn't know what you were. You just wanted to flop into a chair or on a bed. And my own experiences, the intelligence officer would come around and ask you, wherever you were, you know, what happened to you? And if you thought you may have shot at something and got it, or you'd tell him your little story. And he'd complete his records by finding out from the armourers how much ammunition you'd fired and so on and so forth. But there were an element who would be go searching for the intelligence officer. So, you know, everybody's different.
You mentioned a little bit about fatigue there. Mm. And how you felt after an operation, but how physically tiring was it to fly the Spitfire in combat?
I think I'll start at the beginning. The most stressful thing in the whole flying Spitfire aircraft during the Battle of Britain was waiting for the scrambled telephone bell to ring. And you couldn't relax. Well, I couldn't, and I don't think many of the others could. You tried to read a book, or you tried to play draughts, or you tried to sleep. Mostly you tried to pretend to doze. But the phone would ring, and immediately you jumped up. But it was probably to say the NAFI van was coming with tea. So then you flop back and try to relax again. But that whole period of waiting for the phone to ring and the order scramble, by the way, all messages came over the telephone. The bell only rang to alert all the ground crew and everybody that there was a scramble on. So then, from that moment on, in a way, you were not scared because you had so much to think about. Getting into the aircraft, strapping yourself in, hoping that for some reason your engine, hoping that you wouldn't be held up by the engine not firing properly. Because, you know, obviously you did have engine trouble from time to time. I can't remember ever having it. But, you know, it did happen. You left pilots behind. But hoping your engine would start and everything goes smoothly and turning your oxygen on and all things like that. And then taking off information and listening to the controller. Physically, it was not stressful flying the Spitfire at this stage. And I don't think ever you were up long enough during the Battle of Britain in a combat to be genuinely physically stressed out. Towards the end of or after the end, a weariness coming back and possibly a slackness could creep in. But it was more a mental thing than a physical thing. Even if you'd gone pulling round in tight turns or anything like that, you weren't. And of course, you could have had a very bad scare, which again would affect your attitude when you were coming back home. And when you got out of the aircraft, all you wanted to do, the majority of pilots, obviously people differed, but I think I'm talking about the majority now, you just wanted to flop down in a chair and relax. And can hope there wasn't another scramble that day.
Can I ask you how many scramble sorties you may do in a day, on an average, really?
Probably somewhere between 3 and 4. But it, obviously affected by weather. You know, the weather was bad, you're lucky. I mean, you may not even get one, you know, sort of. So there were different things. And if for some reason it was a quiet period, you know, the tactics, the Germans were changing their tactics. But on, I think on one occasion I did 5 in a day, and that was a hard slog. And of course, you probably felt physically tired as well as mentally tired after a day like that. I mean, 3 and 4 was a tiring day, a tiring day.
What durations would the flights be? Again, just an average, really.
The average flight was between an hour and 1 hour. Well, I've got one here, 1 hour 55. That was a real long one. But normally an hour, 1 hour to 1 hour 30. Now I've just seen another in our group for 1 hour 50. 1 hour, 1 hour, 1 hour 25. I think probably, glancing through my logbooks, it looks a patrol would be about 1 hour 30 on average.
And can I ask you a little bit about, obviously, what you'd be wearing when you were flying in combat? Would you have a full flying suit, or would you just wear different?
During the Battle of Britain, if my memory serves me correct, all I flew in was my normal battle dress. I never flew in flying boots. I always flew in. Flying boots were too clumsy. I always flew in shoes. And on the other concession I made to be formally attired, I always flew with a silk scarf round my neck, so I had neck freedom to turn my neck through 360 degrees.
Would you wear your helmet and goggles at all times, or would there be a reason for not doing?
We flew with helmets and goggles. Of course, you're connected up to your oxygen, you're connected up to the radio. At one stage, when I was with 41 Squadron at Hornchurch, it was decided, and I'm talking flying at 30,000 feet where it's very cold, it was decided we'd open our canopies if enemy aircraft were sighted. The reason for this was, if you were in a steep dive in a Spitfire, opening the hood was virtually impossible. If you're a very big fellow, 6 footer, and you can get your feet high enough onto your seat, I think some people have knocked their heads through the canopy. But I certainly wouldn't have been able to achieve that. So someone came up with this idea of flying with the hood open. But it didn't last for long. Various things were brought in from time to time. Probably the most ridiculous tactic that came in, that you flew with, I can't remember what it was called, but something like a tail end Charlie, where you, someone flew above the squadron to weave backwards and forwards to protect the squadron. But it was you were a sicking duck for the 109s. There you were, all sitting on your own. Now then, if the you turn, say, to starboard in part of your weave, and the squadron turn to port, you then had to turn round and catch them up, flies. So they were flying straight and level above the squadron, an absolute sitting duck. And so, again, I can't remember how long this tail end Charlie tactic worked. But we continued to fly in threes right through the Battle of Britain in the two squadrons I was with, which was a fatal formation.
Why was that?
Well, you couldn't move. You were trapped.
Were the Germans flying in a different formation at that time?
Yeah, the Germans were flying the formation that we adopted somewhat later. I mean, certainly in the Mediterranean, we flew in the same formation in what you call a finger four. And you flew further apart from one another. But you weren't two people clamping in onto the man in the centre. He couldn't do it, and you were afraid of colliding with one another.
Because it sounds to me that tactic you were saying about having the tail in Charlie played really into the Germans' hands.
Oh, yeah,
the tactics that they were employing.
It may have been all right for the CO sitting in front, but he was well protected anyway. No one could get at him.
You also mentioned the use of oxygen. Could you tell me a little bit how that worked and what heights you would be using it at and that sort of thing?
As regards oxygen, you turned it on as you, before you took off. You turned it off when you landed. And so the along with ammunition and all the other things, you needed a new oxygen cylinder after every flight.
And what kind of heights would you use oxygen at?
We'd use it from ground level.
All the way?
Yes, because in the heat of the moment, if you didn't turn on at ground level, you'd forget it. And then you'd just pass out.
Squadron leader, could you run me through, really, the kind of pre-flight checks that you would do, a kind of a daily routine of how you would prepare your aircraft prior to an operation during the Battle of Britain, the kind of daily routine that you would run?
Well, it's really nil. You made sure your helmet was in the aircraft. Sometimes you took out your helmet, but it's better to leave it in or connect it up. You left your parachute in. You always see people running with parachutes. You never ran with a parachute. It was always in the aircraft. And that was it. You left the aircraft to the ground crew. You never did anything. Didn't inspect it or didn't look at it.
What would the ground crew do then that would prepare?
Well, they'd get the aircraft serviceable. I mean, if I went out to an aircraft now, whatever it was, I'd go round and check all the control services. I'd check for oil leaks. But I'm enjoying the Battle of Britain. Didn't come into the picture at all. You relied on your fitter and rigger.
I was going to say, would you put a lot of reliance on your ground crew?
Totally. You relied completely on your ground crew. I'd say something about that if you want.
Very well.
Oh, it's when you call to readiness, you go out and roughly check the aircraft you'd been allocated. If you were a flight commander or an officer, you probably got the same aircraft every time. Someone of my lack of seniority got what was left. And you go out, glance at it, but you wouldn't bother checking over an aircraft like you would now if you went flying. What you would ensure that, or I did, sure, some people put their parachutes on the wings, but I always had my parachute already in the cockpit with the straps laid clear so I could get in. I had my helmet already in the cockpit and plugged into the oxygen and the radio connection made. I left everything else to the ground crew. And a close bond built up between yourself and your ground crew. And they were always very interested in what had happened after a particular scramble. There was also some cutting and swearing if you'd had your aircraft was damaged, because that meant another unserviceable aircraft, and the idea was to keep as many aircraft serviceable as possible. But you generally knew your ground crew by their nicknames or personal Christian names. Of course, when I was with 610 Squadron, first of all the ground crew were pre-war auxiliaries, and I knew them all by first name because I'd been in LACs with them. I've been LAC with them. But later on, but not in the Battle of Britain, where you had your own favourite aircraft, you always flew that aircraft. Then, of course, things were a little bit different, but that was in the future, not on the Battle of Britain.
How many ground crew would be allocated to each aircraft?
Only two aircraft, a fitter and a rigger. Someone who looked after the engine and someone who looked after the airframe. But you had armourers who armoured the cars. You had the people who changed the oxygen cylinders. You had the people who checked your radio and all these various frequencies. I don't know, a thing called IFF. Which is identified when you were in the air, you switched it on, that you were friendly. And that's one of the, for instance, the things you had to do before you took off, switch that on. That's why, like, thing like oxygen, if you turned it on the ground, you couldn't go wrong. But when you landed, you just walked away from the aircraft, and that was it.
I imagine during the Battle of Britain, then, that the air crew, the ground crew, were working quite long hours as well.
I know for certain that the ground crew, virtually in all spheres of operations, let alone the Battle of Britain, worked all very extensive, very long hours, and frequently work through the night. But obviously, the ones that were working on or servicing your own aircraft during the course of the day, they'd been up on the aircraft before dawn, and when you left, when you were stood down, then they had to put the aircraft to bed. So they worked long hours than we did, but on the other hand, they didn't have to go up and be shot at. Slight sort of a disadvantage.
You mentioned something about the allocation of aircraft. During the Battle of Britain, would people, obviously I was thinking more of flight commanders, would they personalise an aircraft at all?
A little bit. A little personalisation crept in. Not much. I think probably the can't remember when it's. I honestly cannot remember in the two squadrons I was with anybody personalising an aircraft. But I think it may have gone on in some squadrons. Obviously, it came in later, probably when the Battle of Britain was over, and then people started painting swastikas on their aircraft of the aircraft they've shot down and shot scenes. But I don't recollect it. But again, my memory's not perfect.
And you said, obviously, as a sergeant pilot, you would be allocated an aircraft that was maybe one that you weren't allocated on a regular basis.
As a sergeant, I very rarely flew even the same aircraft 2 days running. In fact, occasionally, I remember, I can't remember which squadron it was on, whether it was 610 or 41 squadron, I'd been allocated pump-pump undercarriage Spitfires.
And you also mentioned that when the aircraft was damaged, would they be patched up as well with and continue to fly, or would they go for a long time?
No, they'd go to maintenance. Well, there was a little bit of repair work done online, but most of the way repair work went over the hangars. And then, of course, as the idea was to keep up you wanted as many serviceable aircraft as possible, they would be worked on all night, all the damaged aircraft. But of course, a lot of them went away to, if they were semi-seriously damaged, the squadron wouldn't attempt to repair them. They'd go away to what you call maintenance units, and luckily you'd get a replacement in.
And could I ask you as well about communications within the aircraft? You mentioned obviously there was a radio. Could you give me a little bit more detail about how you would use the radio and what you would receive from the radio and what kind of output you would give from the radio to?
Obviously, when you got in the aircraft and started up the engine, you immediately switched on the radio in order to know what was happening, because sometimes you were delayed and your engine was overheating. And that frequently happened. And the squadron leader was saying, if you don't let us take off in the next minute, we're going to have to all cut our engines. And that sort of conversation went on. And then when you were airborne, of course, all squadrons had a call sign. I can't remember what our squadron was. But there we are. I tell you just one little funny story to fit it in, may add interest. In 610 squadron, coming from Cheshire, the crest of Cheshire was a wheat sheaf. And it's the Latin underneath was the goddess of wheat, airborne or something like that. But what other squadron pilots used to say to us, the corny bastards are airborne again. I can't remember your question now.